What up, everybody?
Hope you all had a great weekend, 4-day weekend if you're in the States. Memorial Day was a thing. If you're not in the States, well, bummer for you. You just had a 2-day weekend, 3-day weekend, 4-day weekend. I don't know why I said 4-day weekend. People didn't have Friday off. It was just Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Anyways, I don't know what I'm talking about. As y'all know, I never do. This is a great, fun episode. We have the editor-in-chief from Rotten Tomatoes, Matt Atchity. I sit down with him at the Rotten Tomatoes HQ headquarters. And we have a fun little chit-chat, chitty-chat. And I get him to explain how Rotten Tomatoes works, because my friends and I debate this all of the time. And, yes, we talk about that. We talk about some other fun things. Talk about some cool things. It's a really fun conversation. We were pushing the hour there, so we had to end it, but we could have gone longer. And I might, because he's a fun dude to talk to. And we might have him on again real soon, because, you know, we're just two nerds chit-chatting about cool things. So if you like cool things, listen to this show. Listen to this episode. Also, I want to thank all of the I want to thank the new Patreon subscribers. We got a couple new ones this coming up, I noticed. We got shirts mailed out. I'm still waiting on one of you, if you're listening, to respond with your shirt size for your Patreon. But we got the shirts mailed out and ordered. I mailed out some stickers, so y'all should be getting the stickers or have them. I'm going to mail some more out this week if you didn't get any yet. But I mailed stickers out to a bunch of people the other day, last week or 2 weeks ago. I appreciate your listening. Continue to give us good reviews on iTunes. Help us climb those charts. Give us good reviews on iTunes. Our listeners we're getting more and more subscribers on iTunes and on Stitcher and all that. So continue doing that. We appreciate it. And, you know, if you haven't yet and you got a couple extra dollars laying around, go to patreon.com/todaywelearned and do that. Otherwise, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. As long as you're listening, I appreciate it and I thank you. And we got some new franchise episodes coming up with Kyle Newman and I on howl.fm coming up soon. We just did that. What else do I got going on? I don't know. Not much. But I thank you guys for everything, and I hope you enjoy this episode. So without further ado, today we learned number 164 with Rotten Tomatoes editor-in-chief, Matt Atchity.
Gentlemen, let's broaden our minds.
Get this going right now.
All right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the ladies and gentlemen, editor in chief of Rotten Tomatoes, Matt Atchity. We were just talking about how Rotten Tomatoes used to have a podcast.
We had a podcast for a while.
And how you had doing an episode with Bill Paxton.
Yeah.
And
we were doing a recording for our Sirius radio show. Sirius radio show, actually. But we just had, you know, one of the things that allowed that you get to do in a podcast, and this was not exactly a podcast, but it was a similar situation. Bill Paxton comes into the recording studio where we're recording at San Diego, and he's there with a comic book that he's championing to try and get a movie made, and ends up in this discussion about his art appreciation history and how his dad used to take him to art galleries to kind of expand his horizons. And then we end up in this philosophy discussion, none of which made it to air, which is kind of a bummer, but it was great. It was just this really cool conversation. And ever since then, every time I would see a Bill Paxton performance in anything, I was like, oh man, I know that guy's got a lot going on upstairs. And it was, I mean, you always kind of think that anyway, but to get that confirmation, it's like, okay, I know where he's coming from. This is awesome.
You want to hear a good Bill? Do you listen to WTF with Mark Maron?
Yeah.
Did you hear that Bill Paxton one?
Yeah.
Like a week before he passed away. And that dude, he's just like the most real guy.
Yeah. Calls himself a journeyman actor.
Right?
Right. Like, I'm just there.
And then just the stories.
Learn my lines. I'm there to do.
The story's like, he saw Kennedy, the morning he got shot?
Yeah.
And there's a photo of it floating around where he's like on a dude's shoulders. And it's like stories like that. Like, that's one thing, like, I love, you know, podcasting and interviewing people for the last 4 years now almost, is the tangential, you know, obviously there's a motive or whatever to start off each, to sit down, you know, actors or whatever, they have something they need to plug or whatever. But to hear, you know, when you get talking, it's like when you, you know, bonfire stories almost where, you know, you're with somebody.
Right.
And it's like one thing I've always wanted to do is, like, I have host a couple podcasts now. I have one called The Franchise with my buddy Kyle Newman about movie franchises and other things. But there's always been one where I've kind of wanted to just, I don't know who would listen to it, but it's more for me is to just sit down with old people.
Yeah.
Like, I don't care what, you could be an old construction worker or whatever. If you're 80 years old and you're cognizant, I want to hear about, I want to hear some stories.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Right. You want to hear the stories. I'm always fascinated, especially when we got somebody in, when we would, you know, and this is outside of the podcast, but the podcast was a great way to get into this when we had like Clint Howard and we would ask him questions and guys who have long history or even somebody who's only been working for 15 years. I'm always fascinated to see their perspective on how the business has changed. And, you know, especially around entertainment, how things have changed amazingly, right? And even in 10 years, even in 5 years. I mean, from where I sit, like doing what I do, covering entertainment on the internet, it's, you know, I've been doing that for 20 years. And the way things have changed, the stuff that we would do, the things you kind of had to do 20 years ago won't work now. And the stuff that you would do now doesn't work back then, obviously, right? Like, because tastes change, but the technology changes so fast that you have to constantly challenge yourself to follow where the audience goes and understand how the audience can, like, the newer audiences consume things. You know, everybody, you know, around here, there's a lot of talk and you see a lot of media companies doing this. They're chasing the Facebook audience. Right. And which is where you got to go. Right. Like, you want those eyeballs, except that my 13-year-old's not on Facebook. Right.
There's really?
My 13-year-old ain't on Facebook and none of his friends are.
Get out.
Right.
They don't have Facebook accounts.
No.
Like, what?
They're on Instagram. And so Facebook's move was to buy Instagram. Right. Yeah. And that's where those kids went. But they are not on Facebook and they don't think of Facebook the way we do. And so where are those kids going to be? Like, it's the thing that I try and keep in mind is taking the long view. The people that make the decisions about what media gets produced in the future are the ones who are growing up in a media landscape different than the ones we grew up in, right?
Yes, and exactly
right.
It's one thing because it's like, well, they're the different way the medias are changing and the different, it's the Wild West and there it's there's a little bit of a lag. Like, I'm fortunate enough to where I'm getting movies that I would have loved when I was 10 years old. I'm getting TV shows that I would have loved when I was 10 years old, but also I'm 35 years old. And a lot of these kids don't care about, you know, like Chips or movies that are getting remade or MacGyver or whatever.
Right.
The target audience. I mean,
You look at
Jimmy Fallon right now. I was reading he's number two now since the Trump got elected. The Late Late Show with Colbert is number one, but Jimmy Fallon is still the leading in that demographic. Now you look at that demographic. It's also a demographic that doesn't have a ton of money to spend on ads. So that's one thing that blows my mind too. Is they're all these companies on the internet talking about new media, is they're making all these shows and for YouTubers and these 13-year-olds and all this, but they don't have money anyways.
They don't.
To buy things. Their parents do, but it's also like, then you look at, I mean, they're redoing Roseanne, and I'm like, what, who's clamoring? Look, who's clamoring for Will and Grace? Who's clamoring for Roseanne?
Yeah, you know, it's, I feel like there's this,
I'm not shitting on it,
The people
that are making the decisions are a generation above us, I feel like.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought up Chips, because it reminds me of the way I thought about A-Team a few years back, right? Like Joe Carney has A-Team. I love that movie. I think that movie's rad.
I wanted
right?
a second one.
Yeah. I mean, look, like if it was in my power, I'd go hit the slider and jump the score up on that one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Can you do that? Because the tomato meter is a two.
Can you do that?
I will neither confirm nor deny that. Love, really had a great time in that movie. And, you know, I am old enough to have watched that show when it was on the air first run. And enjoyed it at the time. And go back and watch it. And first of all, that show's unwatchable now.
That's
right?
Bad.
Like some
it
of those,
doesn't hold up.
Some of those shows absolutely
nobody
don't.
Dies.
Right. There's a whole tangential conversation we could go down about how Magnum PI holds up shockingly well.
Bro.
But
do you want to do that?
We'll get to that in a minute.
Next week.
We'll get to that. But A-Team, that movie is great. And God only knows who it's for, because, I mean, it's for Joe Carnahan. It's for that cast. And God love him. Like, I think Carnahan's a great director, and that movie kicks ass, and I wish more people would have saw it. But the people that greenlight something like that, or Chips, this is kind of how I thought about Smurfs, was who's this movie for? There's people that are...
Three Smurf movies.
Right, and so that one pays off, right? Because there's clearly enough of an international audience that that's making money. But something like Chips, somebody at Warner Brothers is like, oh, here's an IP we hold on to. I remember it. And there's people who are making these decisions who can't see outside themselves, right? And or don't in a lot of cases. Now, it's easy to armchair quarterback as a guy sitting here where I sit. Yeah. And my whole thing is about analyzing movies. But I do feel like there's a... disconnect. And what you see sometimes is, you know, everybody from there on a PR standpoint and marketing is like, oh, we got to chase these influencers. We got to chase these YouTubers. And because they have audiences and we can capitalize on their success. But I don't feel like somebody has really, I have yet to see someone who's showing that they're really paying attention to why that audience is consuming that media that way. You know, on a similar vein, it's interesting to see how TV is changing in large part because of how we have basically whole series of shows dropping. I mean, whole seasons of shows dropping at once. Right. Yeah. And it changes the storytelling rhythm. Right. Because the extreme example is you go back to something like, and procedurals still do this, right? Like your Law and Orders, you know, SVU still is from an aspect of you can come into that show completely cold and follow it along, yeah. right? Whereas you come in halfway through a Game of Thrones, you're hosed, right? Because you need to have followed that show a long time to really kind of get what's going on, right? Yeah. And
I still don't know.
And
but.
And HBO is kind of okay with that because they don't have to bring in the broad audience because they have a bigger margin on the money that they make because it's a subscriber model. So the extreme example is Netflix. Netflix is doing, and Amazon, they're doing these really neat shows and they drop the whole show at once. But the thing about dropping the whole show at once is you can take 3 or 4 episodes to set up your characters like you see with the Marvel shows, right? Like Luke Cage, Jessica Jones, and Daredevil kind of don't really get exciting until they're like...
You didn't mention Iron Fist.
Because I'm only halfway through Iron Fist. But those shows don't really pick up till you're 3 or 4 episodes in, right?
Yeah.
And I find myself and a lot of people saying, you got to stick it out. Stick it out and it pays off. And that's...
Should you have to stick it out? Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
It's one thing with bingeable because that's a 4-hour sit down. Sure.
That's what I'm talking
about,
right?
That's two movies. That's a Lord of the Rings movie. But if it's on a weekly basis, it's like, I shouldn't have to tune into Game of Thrones. I love Game of Thrones, but there's like, or Young Pope or whatever.
Right.
It's like, I shouldn't have to wait 4 weeks
right.
to get
well,
excited about
Well, and that's the thing
something.
Is, I don't think those shows work that way, but I'm talking about the bingeable shows.
The bingeable shows, I
tell that story.
1,000%.
Right. Now, here's what I'm waiting for, is that somebody who's going to grow up on bingeable shows is going to switch up what you can do with that medium. Because at the end of the day, yes, you know, the biggest difference I've seen in a lot of cases is like, okay, you might have 3 or 4 episodes before it really, really picks up. And it really is like, okay, this is why you have to watch it, right? Because at the end of the day, still linear storytelling.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for somebody to come at it like a Rashomon style.
Okay.
Right? Drop 10 episodes.
Let's pretend I don't know what that means.
Rashomon is the movie where it's 4 aspects of the same event.
Okay.
Seen through 4 different points of view.
So
and
like Usual Suspects or...
Similar,
okay,
right? Like...
Go.
So what I want to see is somebody drop a 6 or 10 episode show. Pick whatever order you want to watch it in. Right? Like, as a writer, like, I don't even know how you would approach that as a story. And something where, imagine a show, imagine a TV series, 5 to 10 hours of TV, where somebody drops something, you get the whole season at once, and really, it kind of doesn't matter what order you watch it in. Right? Is that even possible? Maybe. What it makes me think of is there was a play that used to play here in Los Angeles called, was it Carmen? It was something that used to get done at like one of the VFW halls up on Highland. And I think the name of it was, or Tamara. Maybe it was called Tamara. Yeah, I think it was called Tamara. And it was this thing where you'd have to go see the show 6 or 7 times because it was immersive. And there was scenes that would happen. It took place in this, what was basically laid out as a house. And so some characters would do something in one room, and then a character would walk out and go talk to somebody else in another room, and that first character would go to a third room and talk to another character. So if you wanted the whole scope of the play, you had to follow, you had to go multiple times.
So it's kind of like Sleep No More in New York or whatever, where it's Hamlet or whatever.
Yeah, when I heard of Sleep No More, I was like, oh yeah, this has been, right? So I want, what's the TV binge version of that?
Yeah.
Right. Is there one? And you know, I look at that as somebody of an age that grew up on linear storytelling and have to think, like, how do you do that? There's somebody, I guarantee you, there's somebody who's growing up watching this stuff thinking, well, why do we have to tell this all in order?
Well, and right? I mean, with the video games we have now, too.
Right.
And that same, it's that same, you know, you have these Oculus or even just Xbox games where these kids that are, you know, like your child, 13 years old. They're watching these Netflix shows or they're experiencing Snapchats or everything in fragments or video game storytelling to where it's like, why can't you have, you know, an 8-episode show? You know, the first episode ends with a dude walking in a door and coming out that door and running down the hall to shoot somebody.
Right.
Second episode is everything that happened in that hallway or whatever, in that doorway or whatever.
Right.
You don't need that, but maybe you do for episode 5. Maybe maybe episode 5, it's like you got to go back and watch episode 2.
Right.
I don't know.
Right. Or it's, you know, or in a similar kick, it's like the red versus blue guys, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're going to use Halo as our sandbox to write our own show.
Yeah.
Right, which is genius. Right?
Genius.
You look at somebody like, "Oh my god. How did you even think of that?" Right?
Yeah.
It's things like it, like you're talking about, right? Or and I think in terms of video games, you know, going back to one of the first aspects that I thought did it really well was the very first Knights of the Old Republic game on the Xbox, where you could choose the light side or the dark path, and it would affect your character and the ending you got, right? Choose your own adventure, right?
Yeah.
And then Fable comes out, and Fable has this promise of, like, sky's the limit, like, whatever you do, right? And there was the not Red Dawn, there was another planet, there was another one set on Mars that was a similar game where the promise had been you can kind of interact with the environment, and those didn't quite deliver on that. I think what you ended up with is, you know, a space where we have with, like, World of Warcraft, where these games are, you do end up in these big sandboxes, right? And yeah, there's some linear storytelling, but there's also somebody, like, you can kind of approach something creating your own narrative, which it's fascinating. And so I wonder, you know, where does storytelling in movies and TV end up as the audience, as gaming and the storytelling possibilities? Like, I don't know that we've completely explored all the storytelling possibilities in games yet.
Oh,
right.
I'm
sure that we haven't. Right. Yeah. And so as the technology improves,
Are you a big gamer? Did you play a lot of games? Because you're older than me, but did you play, like...
I played a lot of games back in the day. And
did you ever play Return to Zork?
I did not play Return to Zork, no.
Okay.
I did play the... the text-based games I never really had. And part of it for me is I don't play games on the PC.
Okay.
Because I can't afford to have a PC or a computer become a gaming platform.
It's,
because all will be lost. I don't do that for the same reason I don't do heroin.
Yeah.
Because
I don't play video games anymore.
When I'm at work,
I played it as a kid, but I can't.
We have a...
same with bingeable. Like, it's hard for me to watch shows now anyways because
right.
there's 13 hours. Like, I'm an addictive... I'm a very curious person. when it comes to storytelling, and it's like, even if it's bad, I'm like, well, I gotta know what
here's what happens
now.
When you get older is that, well, partly I'm out seeing movies 2 or 3 times a week, yeah. right? And I'm also on parent time, which means that I get up early.
Yeah.
And so I come home and I'll watch something, and I have this thing I used to make fun of my mom for, to sit and sleep. Like, I'll sit and 30 minutes into a show, I am out. You know, stone cold sober. I'm just yeah. out. And so I've got all these tricks, like I have to have a glass of water and I have to stand up and I can watch stuff here at work sometimes. And but there's also too much TV.
There's just too much TV. Now, on top of that, this brings us to, so to touch on, because it's a spider web. It's almost like right now what I'm thinking of, I have, it's like I'm trying to solve a murder and I have yarn connecting right. everything. So you talked about Magnum P.I.
Yeah.
And how it's an amazing show.
Yeah. Totally holds up.
Totally holds
Shockingly.
Up. And how we were.
Or at least did 5 years ago.
It still does.
Yeah.
It's still great. And how we talked about Magnum P.I. and we talked about how they're using movies and TV to make shows and just nostalgic based purposes. One of the creators of Magnum P.I., Glenn Larson, was notorious for kind of doing the same thing and stealing ideas. So it's, you know, people are like, oh, well, they made a Lethal Weapon show based off of the Lethal Weapon movie. Well, Glenn Larson was kind of doing that in the 80s.
That's old
just
news.
Changing the name.
Yeah,
he, you know, Any Which Way But Loose was turned into BJ in the Bear and so forth. Alias Smith and Jones was a ripoff of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But that goes to wonder with our generation and the making, like they're making a Magnum P.I. spinoff show about his daughter, which
cool.
I don't know how that's going to work. I mean, did he have a daughter? I don't know. Personally, I'm a huge fan of Tom Selleck. I'd rather them just remake it. Like, I love the idea of Magnum P.I. as a character. I'd rather them just reboot it if that's the case.
Well, right. Recast, I mean, like, imagine bringing Selleck back, right? Like, what's and so that's the exciting thing
about
the daughter.
He's still alive.
Right. So that's the exciting thing about the daughter is, like, yeah, you know what? I do want to check in with Magnum 40 years later.
Absolutely.
Like,
that would be. Is he still at Higgins' house? What's he doing?
Right. That would be amazing. That would be amazing.
I mean, they should just make a movie version of Tom Selleck in the Magnum P.I. Make a Magnum P.I. with Tom Selleck.
Or do it as a show, right? Why not? Like, do it as a miniseries.
A miniseries.
Yeah.
They're rebooting all these other shows, but Magnum P.I. was huge.
But we're back to where we were talking about earlier. Like, well, really,
is there an audience?
Who's that for?
No, exactly. Who's that for? Now, they're making these things for all intents and purposes, our generations, right? They're not making them for the younger generations.
Right.
Which, because we had them growing up, we had 13 channels, we had 7 channels throughout our lives where we had to watch these shows. Everybody watched MASH, everybody watched Cheers, everybody watched Magnum P.I. People watch the Smurfs growing up, you know, all of these things. Now, your kids, my nephews, my 7-year-old nephew, there, I just read 2 weeks ago, a friend of mine was developing the Masters of the Universe, and now that's switch hands. That's for me. I watched that growing up. Your kids, my nephews, have so much TV. As we talk, there's too much TV. They have so much content.
Right.
They have so much IP. They can watch a different show. They can watch a different show every 30 minutes, every day, and never watch the same show for all intents and purposes. What in 20 years is going to be their nostalgic? Hey, are they going to be mining for when they're running companies or when we're running companies?
What's going to stick with them?
What is going to stick?
You know, it's interesting because one of the things I find with my kid is that, and I saw this early on with him. So the quick background, he's my stepson. Okay. His mom and I got together when he was 4 and a half. And so it was this, which as a corollary, I'll say, you know, you come across somebody who's got a kid and he walks and he talks and he changes himself. Like, this is great. I can reason with this person. No. For anyone out there listening, in a step parent environment, I'm here to tell you, and people who have babies get this right off the bat. Children are fundamentally irrational. They are not logical. You cannot reason with them. They are basically animals that can talk, and there is no logic. And when you start out with the baby, they get a little bit smarter every day. So by the time they're 4, you're like, oh, this one's doing great.
Yeah.
But you come in as an adult with no experience from the baby end, and you're like, why is this kid not listening to me? Why are they not? I can reason with them.
They're their own human beings.
You know, 2 years ago, I think I just finally started seeing the beginnings of consciousness. So
Yeah.
But that being said,
I mean, I feel that way amongst Los Angeles in general.
Right. That being said, it's awesome. Yeah. It's awesome. You know, no judgment on people who do or don't have kids, but for me, it's
oh, they're
it's
great.
Super, super
I
awesome.
Think, and the fact that they are their own brains
and
it's great. Is
and
bananas.
It, you know, it. I see. You know, also like he and I have a lot of things in common. All I needed was an excuse to start buying action figures. Oh yeah, it went crazy. But he
is he funny? Does he say things?
Oh, he's super funny.
Because my nephew, I've told this story on the podcast before, but I love telling it because it's one of the funniest things I've experienced in a movie theater. 10-year-old nephew, we're watching Rogue One. Okay, silent movie theater. This is the second time I've seen it. We're watching, and he's not notorious for just, you know, I see him twice a year or whatever when I go back to Michigan, right. But he's a funny kid, but he's also kind of weird and peculiar compared to my other nephew, who's way more just whatever.
Right, but the weird kids are the really fun ones.
And
like
my nephew, he's like a quiet, you know, he's big into sports or whatever. He'll laugh and we'll make eye. You know, when we hang out, we'll kind of look at each other and give each other the weird looks. But Rogue One at the end when they're on that base and Chirrut the ship gets blown up. The dude with the ponytail, I can never remember the names. He puts the transponder on the thing,
yeah.
And then he runs back on the ship, and it blows up.
Right.
Right? And then the smoke cloud goes in the sky, then it shows Chirrut or whatever. It shows Baze Malbus.
Right.
Spin around and see the smoke cloud of the ship that got blown up. My 10-year-old nephew says in the theater, "Hey, that's my ride." And I lost
that's
it because
awesome.
That's a – I mean –
That's awesome.
He's putting this, just making fun of this, because it showed him, and he's like, "Whoa!" And it's like,
"Hey, that's my ride.
Hey, that's my ride."
Awesome.
And I'm like, and when I hear, when I, you know, like 10, 13-year-olds, they're their own. They're just like, they got. You think you and I as creatives have crazy, funny stuff going on in our brain? There, it's bananas.
My favorite crowd moment in a Star Wars movie is when they re-released the original films 15 years ago. You know, the updated versions.
Yeah.
And we were at the Chinese, and it's like a concert in there, right? Like every time somebody comes out, it's like the first day that the movie's open. Every time some character comes out, people are going crazy, right?
Yeah.
And get to, the, you know, people there in costume, like it's just, it's the Star Wars party. And get to the part in the first movie where Luke asks Ben, "Can you tell me how my father died?" And Ben says, you know, there's that pause, and he says, "People of mine named Darth Vader betrayed and murdered your father," and the guy in the back of the theater goes, "Liar!" The crowd lost it. It was so funny. The kids are funny. Like my kid, he took improv classes at school, which was cool because I took a bunch of improv classes a few years ago, and they made specifically to help me with my interview skills.
Okay.
And it makes me a better interviewer and a better journalist because when I'm talking to someone, I'm now ready to hear. It makes me, honestly, it made my marriage better. It makes me a better listener.
Yeah.
Right? You have to be a real present, real, real active listener. And so in an interview, somebody will say something and it's like, oh, that, because when you're doing improv, you're listening for that unusual thing and you want to follow that thread. Right. And so when somebody will say something that seems offhand, I now have, and a lot of people naturally have this, but I now have the presence to say, oh, that's interesting. Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
So I bring that up because I did these improv classes. My kid decided to do some. And so now he and I yes and each other all
that's
the time
amazing.
At home, to the point that my wife's like, okay, guys, enough.
Enough of the bits. Are you guys doing
a
bit?
We just do a bit. Now he yes ands the dog, right? The dog does something. And now he's spent the last 3 weeks he'll be doing dog impressions, and he does a good dog impression. Like he does exactly what our dog does.
That's amazing.
And it's hilarious. It's weird, but hilarious. Because we rescued this pit bull like 6 months ago. And
oh wow.
Yeah. Which has been great. She's
a pit bull.
Yeah. Pit bull. Yeah. That's what they have at the shelters. You go to the shelter, you look for
it's
a dog.
These, and it's pit bulls.
Easily 75% pit bulls.
Really?
Yeah. Easily.
I believe that, I guess.
Yeah, it was somewhat of a surprise, but as you think about it, it's like, oh, all right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you do the math, you follow the trail.
Right. You know, and our pit bull had a history of getting into an incident with another dog that had been, I guess, our dog is 4.5 years old, had been in a house in a family situation for 2 years from birth till whenever. And there was an incident with the smaller dog that they'd been living together just fine. And then something happened and there was an incident and the other dog had to be put down. Smaller dog. Because the thing about the breed that we have, American Staffordshire Terrier, is that from what I've read, they won't necessarily start something, but by God, they'll finish it.
So, known as an Amstaff.
Amstaff, yeah.
Or simply Stafford, is a medium-sized, short-coated American dog breed.
Yeah. And she's a sweetheart. She's an absolute love bug, but she does get barky around other little dogs. As my brother says, little dogs are racist because they bark at your big dog, and then your big dog barks back, and your big dog gets in trouble. So we are working on training Sabrina to be able to coexist peacefully with other small dogs.
Was that a name you gave it?
Or no, she came with that name.
A pit bull named Sabrina.
And, you know, like they say at the shelter, she picked us. She absolutely picked us. We went to the shelter, looked at a bunch of dogs. Like, we were there for 3 or 4 hours, which somebody said.
Which shelter did you go to?
We went to the Best Friends.
Okay.
Up in Mission Hills.
I feel like it's either Best Friends or another one. A bunch of my friends are big into fostering dogs. And I think they might. I think that one of them might do it with Best Friends.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of great dog shelters out there.
Yeah, and it was a great experience. So we went there, you know, looked at some dogs and kind of looked at the ones that were in the pens and kind of responding. And so, you know, they take you into this little yard area and say, okay, bring us Patty Cake. And this dog, Patty Cake, comes out who likes me and likes Gabriel and then wants nothing to do with my wife. And so, all right, well, Patty Cake, you're cute, but not the dog for us. And then they bring out this other dog, Mr. George. And Mr. George likes my wife and likes Gabe, but couldn't give me the time of day. Yeah. So Mr. George is out. And then Sabrina comes out and immediately just up on all of us, like just rubbing up against us and on her back and presenting her belly. And it's like, all right, yeah, this one picked us. And as we were leaving with her and doing the paperwork and say to the volunteer, like, this is the one we want. We want Sabrina. She's like, okay, I need to tell everybody. And gets on the walkie-talkies, like, hey, everybody, Sabrina got found a home. And like 10 volunteers come up to say goodbye to her. So, you know, I think it's a measure of the love that those volunteers have at the shelter, but also Sabrina's the popular dog.
They, according to Wikipedia here, the temperament of those types of dogs, according to the American Kennel Club, the Amstaff is a people-oriented dog that thrives when he or she is made part of the family and given a job to do. Although friendly, the breed is loyal to its own family.
Yes.
So it's clearly, you know, it chose all of you as the family.
Although she does now bark if I get too cuddly with my wife. She gets jealous. So we're working on that too.
What so back to your 13-year-old. What is he into now? Like what
so
are
right
they
now
into?
he's deep into Overwatch.
Okay.
Because that's the new game and he's playing
game.
That online.
Everybody plays that game.
He's playing on Overwatch. I've learned not to play games with my son because he's much better than I am, which was a bitter pill to swallow. I was all excited because currently we have an Xbox One and a PS4. And
how are you going to teach him what it's like to lose?
Well, so I'll get to that in a second. So we also have a Wii. We didn't get the Wii U, and I've been a 3-console guy for a long time because I fall prey to the killer app. Like, what's the game that I have to play? All right, a new Zelda, I got to go get that.
Sure.
You know, what keeps me getting a PlayStation is that there'll be a new Gran Turismo. And so the racing game, which I have to play.
Did that start on the 3DO? What did Gran Turismo start
on? I think it started on the PlayStation.
On the PlayStation.
But I'm a racing game guy. Yeah. That's what I play. And so we didn't get the Wii U, and we don't have a Switch because my wife has put her foot down. But when we were still playing the Wii, I brought home Super Smash Brothers. I'm like, oh, okay, this could be fun. And we started playing. Now, I had falsely assumed that Gabe hadn't played much, and it was as if I was not even holding a controller. and it was, oh, okay. And so we, you know, we have Battlefront. We'll play the Star Wars Battlefront, and I just can't compete. But my games are racing games. He won't race with me because I'm unbeatable. And partly because he doesn't drive, but I play a lot of racing games. So that's where I still have him beat. So he would rather watch me play the new Forza and the expansions because I can get all the achievements and win all the races. He'll do some of them, but he's just not there yet. When it'll be a very, very sad day for me when he can outrace me. And I'm sure that's coming.
Racing
not
games
there
are
yet.
Your thing, huh?
That's
Cruising
thing.
USA.
I used to
pole
play.
Pole position.
Back in the day, I spent a lot of time on the Sega playing San Francisco Rush.
Okay.
A lot of time. when a new Gran Turismo comes out, I have told my wife, you know, when the last one came out, it's like, I'm going to just disappear for a few months in the game room because that's what I'll be doing.
Yeah.
So I come down, I come, like, that would be my wind down at the end of the day, like, blow a couple hours racing. Although now that we have this dog that I come home and she greets me at the door, I come home and spend 30 minutes petting the dog, and it's like this super zen moment. So, you know, that and like going out to screenings and all the TV, like I get less time gaming than I mean, that's, it's not that I don't want to continue to game. You know, I've always wanted to go through the Mass Effect series. I just don't have the time. And
they're time consuming.
They are time consuming. And it's, I find that, I mean, you know, cry me a river, like seeing three or four movies a week is great, but I'm seeing three or four movies a week on top of working, you know, being in the office 40 hours a week and then trying to catch up on TV, which I've given up the concept of catching up on TV, right? It's that I can maybe stay on top of one or two shows at a time.
What are you watching right now?
Right now, I am watching, I'm current on American Gods, okay, and I'm 20 minutes back on Better Call Saul, and that's and I'm caught up on Veep, and that's about all I can stay up
can
on.
Can stay on this three shows. Now, current American Gods, you've seen the first three?
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't have time to watch the first four that were in the preview that got sent out. I'm kind of in real.
I saw the first four. I mean, if I wanted to, I could be up to eight, but I want to watch it. Right. I'd rather, because I like reading about it. So it's like,
well, right, because you, like, it's a shared experience.
I'd rather, I'm seeing everybody. I mean, I watched the first four, you know, a month and a half, 2 months ago, you know, and I see everybody, you know, jerking off about it on Twitter. And I'm like, it's great, but I don't know what you guys are feeling right now, because I also watched two at a time in a row. So I was like, it's, well, I almost robbed the, everybody's talking about how it's this
amazing
show.
Well, you're out of the conversation.
Right? I'm out of the conversation.
That's the thing. Like, that's one of the great things about TV in a way that, I mean, this is one of the things I
talk
about.
Water cooler every eight.
Well, and one of the things I talk about with the difference in covering movies and TV is that it seems like on its surface, it should be easy to do both, but it's actually really, really different because, you know, this is getting a little inside baseball, but from a journalism standpoint and a way, you know, when, especially online, when you're looking at, which is where almost all journalism is these days, right? Because as a journalist, you are now responsible for growing the site in a, or traffic, or not even just the site, right? As you're on, you know, as people are talking about publishing and engaging on Facebook and Twitter and all the social channels, we no longer have the luxury that you used to have as, you know, as a broadcast or print journalist, where it's like, look, like you're, the pool is smaller. Now it's so much in real time. And all that to say that where that plays out with movie and TV coverage is that movie coverage, like it, movie coverage has not changed the way, in a modern journalism sense, the way TV does. Movie coverage is still about this event that's going to happen, right? If you watch the way people cover movies, almost all of the coverage is, it's advanced coverage. It's people talking about the excitement. And the way I think about it, it's, there's a party that's going to happen. There's a, there, you know, Warner Brothers is going to hold a party in early June, and the theme is Wonder Woman. And here are the hints about what's going to happen at the party, and but it's all this party, and get excited because this is the party. And where critics come into the ad equation is like, hey, we got into this party early. We can tell you whether or not it's actually worth going to.
When's that embargo lift?
That embargo, last I heard, is late this month.
That's cutting it close for, what is it, June 2nd release?
It is June 2nd release. That's yeah, it's close. We'll see. I have inside information I'm not allowed to share.
Correct.
But I'm hopeful that there's a good response to it, is the best I can say. 2 weeks after that movie opens, you're not really talking about it, right? Like, you're more on the line, and unless there's been some major catastrophic bomb, or it's doing amazing box office, and even then the coverage is, boy, that party didn't really work, that party wasn't as successful as everyone thought, or it's, well, I can't believe, you know, like Titanic, right? Titanic continues to dominate the box office for 2 months, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was also a different generation where, you know, movies were in. Like, Back to the Future was, like, what, in the theaters for 9 months?
Right.
I mean,
But with Titanic, the coverage was, I can't believe people are still going to the store. Right? TV is a totally different thing, because TV coverage is, the best way I could describe it is if we are thinking about the party that we're going to around a movie, with television, we have very personal relationships with the characters of those shows. And I think that they, my theory is that if you were to put someone in an MRI and talk to them about family members and then talk to them about characters and shows they'd watched, I think that they're the same parts of the brain would light up, right? I have that theory, and it would be, if I ever get an MRI, I'm going to do that. But that's the way I could describe it, is that I think that people talk about characters. You know, when we talk about Game of Thrones, we may talk about the odd battle scene, but like, we're really talking about Tyrion. We're really talking about Daenerys. We're really talking about Jon Snow. And what that means is, from a coverage standpoint, you have to be really on top of those conversations as they happen, as the audience gets access to the show, right? So, you know, with a broadcast show, and the DVR thing has made that more difficult sometimes, right? It was ruthlessly joking today, and people online especially get really mad. My attitude is, spoiler windows, 24 hours. 24 hours.
Unfortunately, right? We live in the world where... Right.
24 hours. I have no mercy. 24 hours, I'm going to tell you everything that happened. Like, you don't like it?
Yeah.
If you're really a fan and you need those spoilers, like, and people get mad at me all the time, and I get it. Like, I say it as somebody whose job is to be on top of this. So I know people will come back to me, and I hear people on the audience going like, yeah, but I can't watch something. Like, what if I have life going on? Like,
I
get it. Yeah. But then the show's not that important to you. Like, right. But that's, then you're not a real fan.
Yeah.
But from a standpoint of journalism, like, Wednesday after, I'll put it this way, on Thursday after the Game of Thrones season premiere, I can't afford to wait till Thursday to talk about it.
No,
I have to be talking about as much as I can that night without spoiling anything, and get deeper into spoiler territory as the days go by.
Yeah.
And which makes covering the binge shows really difficult, because the rhythm of how people consume Iron Fist is a good example, right? Like, I'm halfway through Iron Fist, and, you know, we called it like 18% on the tomato meter. Like, it's their first real bad one. And I'm watching it, I'm like, it's not that bad. Like, it's okay. It's not great, but it's okay. And it does a lot of the stuff so far that the other shows have done, and I'm kind of into it. Now, am I riveted and like burning right into the next one the way I had with Luke Cage? I'm not, but I'm still kind of, and partly because I'm invested in that universe. And, you know, I'm at the point where Rosario Dawson shows up, and I was like, oh, well, I'm a little bit invested in Claire. So I kind of want to keep watching what's going to happen with Claire, because I want to see, like, that's the glue for me now, right? Which is a smart move on their part. But it does make covering and talking about the binge shows messy, because so many of the audience, so much of the audience is consuming it at such varied rates and varied rhythms that it becomes really tough to be on top of. And then there's people who pointedly go back to the shows that they would rather just binge all at once. Like, I found myself doing that with The Expanse, which I love that show. Somebody here turned me on to The Expanse, and I burned through the first season about 5-6 months ago. And then the second season premiered, and I watched, I think, the first episode. No, I actually didn't watch it. I was like, oh, that's on. And I made a conscious decision. You know what? I'm going to wait till it's done and watch it all at once. I'm just going to wait. And I see a lot of people doing that.
I agree. I know a lot of people that will wait. They're like, I'll just binge it when the show's done. Like,
right.
my brother, some of them is like Game of Thrones, I think he's like, I'll watch it when it's all done or whatever. Now,
yeah, that was my attitude with that book. Ugh. Remind me to talk to you about fantasy books.
Now, two things you said struck a chord in me. One, well, before we end, I want to have you explain the tomato meter to me, because I've had many conversations with friends, and normally
it's deceptively simple.
Generally, like the last couple years, it's been very flawed on my scale.
Okay.
Because usually it was like I look at the tomato meter and I'd agree with it. But I would say over the like the last 2.5 years, I'm like, man, Tomatoes is really hosing me. They're really screwing me over here. You know, Lost World of Z was not what it was. It was a bad movie. But in my opinion, so we'll talk about that. But also, you talk about binging and you talked about, do you think, and you're watching Iron Fist and you're liking it. Now,
I am
enjoying it enough.
I'm enjoying it enough to keep watching it.
Do you think there's something inherently flawed with the acceptance of shows that we can binge, much like how it takes four episodes to get into it? Do you think we're more accepting and we enjoy shows more that we can pound through 12 episodes at once and get the full story versus if it was a weekly show over 12 months or 12 weeks? Do you think we would be way more critical if we had to wait weeks at a time? And then rather than say a show's say it's almost like if it does this show hold up. Do you know what I mean? Like if the A-Team, if we watched all of the A-Team episodes at once and it was great. Right. But now you go back and you look at it, individual episodes, and you realize it's a bad show.
Well, I did an interesting, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. Do you know what I mean? I did a thing years ago where I took some time off to deal with a health issue, and that's when I binged Magnum PI. But after I binged Magnum, I watched all of Star Trek, like all of it, like in order, the whole thing.
TOS to TNG.
TOS, animated show, TNG, DS9, Enterprise, Voyager, all the movies, everything. And the funny thing when you watch something like, what I noticed with, less so in TOS, but more so in TNG, you would see the same effect shots show to show.
Yeah.
The same ones. Yeah. And when you binge watch them, you're like, yep, there's the fly-off shot. There's this shot. There's shot number 7. There's shot number 8. Oh, they'll go back to shot number 2. Like, you start to notice those little things. To your question of audience acceptance, it's an interesting thing because there's the business requirements around the storytelling and performance are so different depending on the medium in which the show is placed, right? On a broadcast show, you have to appeal to a large enough audience to sell enough ads to justify the budget of the show. Procedurals are great for that, right? You can jump in and out of a procedural anytime. They're comfort food. I never watch Law and Order at home, but I go on the road. I go out to, you know, I go to New York, I go wherever. I'm like, oh, there's Law and Order in. I'm in. It's great because it's you know what you're going to get. It's easily accessible. They've changed, you know, it's reruns. God only knows who the cops are. God only knows who the lawyers are. Doesn't matter, right? And that's what procedurals are great at. When you dip into the shows that have more of an arc, it gets riskier, especially as your budgets go up, right? You could do a cheap arc show on a broadcast network and not need the performance numbers, but you know, I'm somewhat, as much as I like the show, I'm somewhat surprised Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has managed to stay on as long as it has. Like, that's a bubble show, right? Yeah. And they're coming back for a 5th season, I hear. Great. That's awesome. I'm going to watch Inhumans because I'm a big Marvel geek, but it's, and I do, like, I like all the actors on that show, but they have to stay broad. They can't do the storytelling risk.
Did you like Legion?
I haven't watched Legion. I haven't had a chance to. Although I did have that original comics run with, if people haven't watched that or read that original New Mutants run with that beautiful art by Bill Sienkiewicz, I strongly recommend picking it up. I was 14, I think, at the time when those comics were coming out, and I didn't get the art. I was like, oh yeah, man, I love the New Mutants, but I can't handle this art. And I want to go back and slap myself in the mouth because that impressionistic, moody, genius art that Sienkiewicz did is like really pushing the I mean, it looks like what's his name, who was illustrating, who did the Stedman. It looks like, it like feels like Stedman work.
You as a kid reading comic books, you take for granted the visual, the art, artistic visuals of the actual comprising the shots, a film director.
Yeah, exactly. The cinematographer, and just the you take it for granted. And Sienkiewicz's impressionism in that form is so like, it's such a right angle to what everybody, you know, I was a John Byrne kid, right? And because it was like neat, clean lines, and like I could process it, and my artistic sensibility had not developed yet. And now, like, I'll take Sienkiewicz over John Byrne 9 times a day, right? Yeah. And not that John Byrne's not talented, but I want to see somebody whose art can really enhance the mood of the story and become part of that itself. To get back to what I was talking about with TV, you see on the cable shows things like Walking Dead. You know, as you get more into a subscription model, there's, I think, a direct, it's like inversely proportional amount of pressure on ratings performance, right? So when you get into something like Walking Dead on AMC, there's a lot of subscribers who have AMC who may never watch AMC, but they are subsidizing that show. The other side of that is we're all subsidized. I subsidize ESPN. I never watch anything on ESPN, right? But it's bundling. And when you hear about people talking about separating out and a la carte pricing, that will wreak havoc on shows, on the ability of producers to come up with shows like Orphan Black and Legion even, and The Walking Dead, because they will end up having to compete the way broadcast shows do. HBO can spend millions of dollars per episode for Game of Thrones, because as long as their subscribers are tuning in, fine, right? If they can show that their subscribers are tuning in and upping their subscriptions, re-upping their subscriptions to stay on top of Game of Thrones, they'll keep making that show. But they don't have to hit, if they, the, they would otherwise be, I mean, you couldn't ever do a Game of Thrones on an NBC. Like, the just money, the money would never be there, especially as there's so much competition. And so the extreme example, the other end of the spectrum from a procedural on NBC, is these Netflix shows where you can drop the whole season at once. They can be really niche appeals. I mean, yeah, look, there's a lot of people who watch House of Cards, but there's a lot of people who are watching, there's less people who are watching some shows that are still getting renewed. Aziz Ansari's show, right?
Yeah, like Modern Lover Master of None.
Master of None, great show, right? Now, Netflix wisely doesn't release numbers, but I'd be shocked if that was a particularly highly viewed show. That's a niche audience, but that's okay, because they can see internally, and as long as they keep their subscribers up, because they get all of that money, right? Yes, they have to pay for the show, but all of the subscriber money, they're not, it's not like they have ad money that they have to show performance to justify a high ad rate. So all that to say that when you're asking about, is it fair for a, I think that what we've ended up is you allow creators to take risks in these serialized linear stories that they wouldn't otherwise be able to take. And I think that's
with
still,
bingeable shows.
With bingeable shows. And I think we're still, I think that medium is still evolving. Right.
But those risks, like say the Expanse. I'm not familiar with it, but you watched it bingeable, and it's a weekly show on what channel?
On Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi. Yeah. Okay, so it's released weekly.
Yeah.
Now, did you watch any of the second season yet?
I did. I binged the second season.
Okay, so you binged the second season. Binged when does the third season come out?
No idea.
Say there's a third season. You love the first two seasons, right?
Yeah, I will likely binge the third season.
Now, but I guess if you watched it individually, would you be more critical, I guess? Do you know what I mean? Like, are
right.
we more
would
accepting?
It need to,
like the
right.
OWA. Did you watch the OWA on Netflix?
I have not watched the OWA
yet. I haven't watched it. But I remember when it dropped, many of my friends were talking about how amazing it was because they're binging them and binging them and binging
right.
them. And then when it ended, they really thought about it. And most of those friends that were talking about how great it was when they were binging it were very, they felt like they were robbed, and they realized that they didn't enjoy it. So I guess my wondering is, if are we more likely to like something when it's constantly, we can watch the whole thing, versus like you love The Expanse season one, but would you have loved it as much, or would you maybe have given up on it had you had to watch each of those episodes when it came out? Do you know,
you know, that's an interesting question. I think part
like
of
I get there's still the artistic aspect
right.
for bingeable, but would Master of None be as enjoyable
yeah,
if you had to watch it?
That's a good question. You know, it makes me think of like, would I have been as upset with the first season of True Detective if I had binge watched that show, as opposed to have these
exactly.
monstrous cliffhangers, right?
Correct.
And so you get to the point where you're thinking, oh boy, this is going to pay off something huge, right? And you end up in Lost territory.
Or like, even True Detective season two, where people hated it.
Right.
But if you watched it all at once, it's would you have enjoyed it more?
Right. Maybe so, right? It's, you know, you end up in this territory where, you know, and I wonder with some of these shows, like, I don't feel like The Expanse does this, because I think The Expanse is this epic show similar to Game of Thrones, where it's telling 20 stories, or, you know, stories of, like, there's such a big canvas, and it's this epic story that's telling very urgent stories for certain characters, and they sometimes cross over, and you're getting a sense of, similar to Game of Thrones, like, there's world-shaking events, but characters may never meet, right? And when they do meet, it's like, oh, yeah, I had never actually thought of those people, right? And their stories are interesting, you know, essential to them, but it may, right? Like, when Daenerys finally meets Cersei, that's going to be interesting, right? But they've been so separated for so long, right? And so there's a sense of, you know, in some of those stories, in the big stories that tell, sometimes that works really well, right? Sometimes because you can keep your narrative lean on, I wonder if that means you can keep your narrative lean and focused on certain characters. I mean, I say this ironically with Game of Thrones, where I feel like that story has totally gotten away from Martin.
Yeah.
But
as
opposed to, you're basically following two guys in True Detective, and you keep twisting and throwing things in there that you get to a point where, can you even come up with an ending that is satisfying, right? It's same with Lost, same with Galactica, right? And I loved Galactica, but
I binged it and then I stopped halfway through because it was like, I got...
Right. I think that there's moments in...
22 episodes a season wasn't...
Cut that in
half.
Right. And I feel like there was some stuff... I mean, Ron Moore did some stuff in Galactica that I think will go down as some of the... Like, to me, some of the finest moments of television I've ever watched. But you get to that ending and, you know, you start to wonder, like, oh man, I think these guys hadn't thought their ending out before they got there, right? Whereas I think the difference with Game of Thrones, and maybe not necessarily with The Expanse, but like The Expanse has 6 or 7 novels of source material they're going through, right? Similar with Game of Thrones. And I guarantee you with Thrones, Martin's got his end game. He may not have written it yet, or certainly not published it, but he's got an end in mind that he's getting to. Now that he's taking his own sweet damn time getting there.
Time,
and I won't get off on my rant on how it's pissing me off that he's writing about new pilots. Like, dude, I don't want to hear anything from you.
He hasn't had a new book since this show started.
Right. Well, right. I mean, which is fine. Like, look, like, it's great to be at this point where book readers and watchers are now all in the same boat. But Game, you know, it's funny because that book series was the one time that I ever went back on my rule of I would never start a fantasy series until the author was done because I didn't like to wait. And so this one, it's like I came across it. It's like 3 books and it's like, oh, he's going to write 5 books. Like, okay, well, sure. Like, I've read a bunch of other stuff by Martin. He's a pro. He cranks stuff out. And so I get to the 3rd book, and it's like, well, the 4th one will be out next year, and I get that. And then there's this huge gap, and I'm like, God damn it. The one time that I don't wait.
Rotten Tomatoes, explain this meter to me.
Okay, so the tomato meter is real simple. Believe it or not, we mark every review fresh or rotten, thumbs up or thumbs down. And the tomato meter is a percentage of people that said, yes, this is good.
So it's not looking at the percentage. That's not its own scale of, it's either a yes or no.
It's either a yes or no.
It's a yes or no.
What percentage of people said yes? That's it. Now, it can be a grudging yes. It can be an overwhelming yes. In broad strokes, it's rare that something will be up in the 90s with grudging yeses. Like that doesn't happen much. It tends to bear out not far off of where the average ratings are. Now, we do have average ratings.
Yeah.
We will ingest or let critics mark ratings like a star
our
rating.
Star scale.
And then we'll normalize that and do an average. And the averages aren't that hugely different. You know, maybe.
So on a 5-star.
So on a 5-star.
On a 5-star rating, the average 5-star rating, right? That tends to be the average, or you have the 10, I think, on Metacritic or whatever. What on a 5-star scale, what qualifies as rotten?
It depends on that critic.
Really? So, 2 stars.
So
would be, could be, 2 stars could be a positive tomato.
Depends on the critic, right? So what, right, that comes up all the time because it's inconsistent, right? So a 3.5 out of 5 might be fresh to one critic and it might be rotten to another. And we check with them. We talk to the critics all the time because we want to accurately represent.
Okay.
So yes, it will look inconsistent within the environments, within a particular set of reviews for a particular movie. And we see that on our social channels. Like, hey, you marked this one, this three out of five fresh and the other 3 out of 5 rotten. And the answer is, well, it's different from critic to critic. Right. It just is. So people will say sometimes, well, but that's 60% by your own thing. 60% is fresh, like different scale.
Do you on Rotten Tomatoes have your own thing where you review movies?
I do not.
You do not movies.
I do not. I review movies with Ben Mankiewicz,
okay,
of Turner Classic Movies, and Alonzo Duralde of The Wrap, and Christy Lemaire, formerly of At the Movies, and we have a show called What the Flick that,
okay,
is on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
Okay, check that out.
My reviews do not count towards the tomato meter because, as my wife informs me, that would be a conflict of interest.
Okay. Let's talk about a conflict of interest.
Okay.
Because you're into, you like cool things, it seems like.
Yes.
And look, I've never made a movie. And I mention this all the time when I talk about not liking movies. Ghostbusters.
Yes.
2016.
Okay.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was all right. I did not hate it.
You thought you did not hate it. What would that be? Would that be a rotten or a fresh? On a 5-star scale, what would you give it?
On a 5-star scale, if I was reviewing it, I can't remember what I said on What the Flick, because that review is probably up. Off the top of my head, I probably would have given it like a 5.5 or 6. Like to me, the dividing line is 5.
Okay.
Right? Anything above a 5 is like, okay, sure. Right. And for me, that one was like, it's fine. It's fine. It's harmless. Okay. Right. It's not a waste of time.
Do you think it could have been better?
It could have absolutely been better.
Do you think it's a 73% on Rotten Tomatoes?
Well, I know it's a 73% because
yeah,
well, see,
it is. It
right.
is.
So but, I know it is because 73% of the critics say, at least say, sure, it's fine.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yes. According to the math.
According to the math. Yeah. Right? Now, do I think it deserves that? It deserves got nothing to do with
it.
Right?
That's a very interesting thing because of the way it is. It's either
right.
a yes or a no.
Right.
Do you think that deserves that? So I guess I guess over time, like in my case, how Rotten Tomatoes has been flawed as far as, you know, how I judge movies is either maybe there's more critics who are more accepting, or maybe just over time, like comedy, views change and people are
right.
more accepting of things and more enjoyable of things. So
right.
that's a...
Well, you know, and there's a lot that goes, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts to it. You know, one of the things I tell people all the time, like, look, you want to go see that movie, go see that movie.
Yeah.
Right. Or you don't want to go see it, don't go see it. Fine.
Yeah.
Where I think we really make a difference is that what we really do, I think the best thing that we can do is we help smaller movies find an audience they wouldn't otherwise get. I think that's our best ability.
Yeah.
I don't know why that's ringing. I thought I had turned that off. Sorry.
Oh, no worries. No worries. Yeah. We'll wrap it up soon anyways.
Yeah. That's where I think we really can move the needle, or critics can, right? And we represent what critics are saying. I think that at best, the critic service is to help. The best face of what a critic can do is they can turn you on to a movie that you may not be on your radar at all. That's why award season is so much fun, because you get to see all these really cool movies. The other side of it is, you know, people will say like, oh, critics hate movies. Couldn't be more wrong. Critics, nobody loves movies more than film critics.
Yeah.
You would have to be some kind of masochist to have a job where your position required you to watch movies and analyze them. Critics think about movies all the time.
Yeah.
And the way I think about it, it's, I go into every movie hoping it's going to be good. I may not want everything to be good, but I hope it's going to be good. I hope, you know, and there's an attitude that some critics have where it's like, all right, what do you got? Right. And I think that's okay. I think we should be, I don't begrudge anyone enjoying popcorn movies. I enjoy what you love. Like, that's great. I love every Fast and Furious movie. Every so single one.
I love them. I agree.
I liked Need Rest for Speed. Peace, huh? And Need for Speed is not a good movie, but I liked it.
Yeah.
I love, there's a lot of schlock that I love. But artistic merit is a different question. Like, does this movie have artistic merit? Is this the best version of this story? Is a different question than did I enjoy it, right? And again, don't begrudge anyone loving something. Don't, not at all, because again, like, there's plenty of garbage that I love. There's plenty of great movies I love. There's movies that critics love that I can't stand. Tree of Life from a few years ago. I hated that
movie.
It's
a bad movie.
A lot of critics are like, oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah. I don't know what they saw. But at the end of the day, like, I feel like where, you know, the other thing is, I feel like I hope that we are exposing critics to an audience that otherwise wouldn't be paying attention, right? And again, like, one of the things that we can do is, like, if you're on the fence about a movie and we're helping you make that decision, great, right? That's at the end of the day, like, that's a big part of what we're trying to do. But, you know, for all the people that, like, love Batman v Superman, I personally thought that movie's a mess, but if you love that movie, great.
Yeah.
I may be love worried about love, you know? But love what you love. Like, totally fine.
Yeah. Be I guess, you know, that's a bad movie, but love, if you love Batman vs. Superman,
hey,
good for you.
Like,
hey, it's, you know, it's, right, it's not good, but
let's,
you know,
not pretend that it's high. I mean, there are, like, the Zack Snyder apologists out there. Okay.
No, he's not good.
Fine.
But I've never, like, made a movie, but it's not good.
Right. I, you know, but, it, yeah, right.
Matt, thank you so much for doing the show.
Sure.
Where can everybody find you on the internet?
RottenTomatoes.com. They can follow me on Twitter at Matchety. They can follow pictures of my dog on Instagram at Matt Atchety on Instagram.
And watch the show on the Young Turks.
Yeah, Young Turks. And, you know, from time to time, I might write something on the site.
Awesome. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. As always, give us 5-star ratings on iTunes.
That would be fresh.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, everybody.